Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for taking your seats promptly. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Melinda Salento. I'm the CEO of CEDA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. It's lovely to have you all with us here today. Can I start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we're meeting, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation? And I'm going to pause there because I don't want it to just roll off as a tick-a-box sort of exercise. I would like to take this opportunity to ask you all to reflect on what that actually means, to think about the tens of thousands of years of history and culture and tradition and the connection to this place, of people who have been meeting as we are now, to share knowledge, to share a meal, and to exchange views and perspectives. And for me, that's what the acknowledgement of country means, is recognising that connection and recognising how special and unique we are as a nation to have that as part of our history and to reflect on that and what it means for us as a nation. CEDA has and will continue to be a supporter of the empowerment of First Nations voices, people and communities, and we'll look to advance that through our work always. I would really like to thank the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia for inviting us to partner on this event. We're really pleased to work with them. The issue of tax reform is one that's near and dear to all of our hearts, obviously, but it's not always a conversation that's easy to get attention on, nor to actually drive progress and implementation reform. So really keen to be a part of this conversation, not as a one and done, but to think about how we can actually see something change after a long period of having the same conversation. I would like to acknowledge, welcome and honour Professor Hancock. Thank you so much for being with us. This is, of course, the annual Keith Hancock Lecture, so we're very privileged to have you with us, and thank you so much for joining us and for your contribution for so many, many years to this country. I should pause here. Sue's not on the list, but I do need to acknowledge Sue Richardson as well. I'm going to carbon date myself now. Sue and I have known each other for a very, very long time, going all the way back to when I actually did my honours, and Sue was involved in teaching me then, and hopefully I learned a lot then and have continued to learn from you and others. So I'd like to acknowledge Sue as well. I'd also like to welcome Academy President Richard Holden, CEO Chris Hatherley, and Academy Fellows Professor Bob Brunig and Dr. Ken Henry. Bob, of course, is a board member at CEDA and chairs our Research and Policy Committee. And in continuing to join my dots with people in this room, Ken was one of my first bosses at Treasury, so I'm sure he'll be marking my homework as well. Can I thank Deloitte for sponsoring this event? You know, we can't pull audiences like this together and do the work that we do without fantastic partners like Deloitte, and I really do appreciate their support for today's event. I've mentioned Bob Brunig, but also in the room we've got Pradeep Philip from Deloitte and Richard Yetzenga from the ANZ, who are also members of CEDA's board. And I would also like to acknowledge Warren Mundine, who's been a long-time supporter and sort of member and contributor to CEDA's work. I think there's media in the room, so we'll acknowledge them and thank them for being interested in this conversation. For you in the audience, we'd love to have you participate in the conversation today. You can do that by logging onto the Pigeonhole app and asking questions and rating and ranking other people's questions. So if you're interested in something, it moves up the list. And we will have some mics in the room. If you want to log on to Pigeonhole, you can do that through the QR code on your table. And not surprisingly, the password is tax reform. What else have I got to say? Usual phones to silent. And then all I need to do now is to introduce Stephen Smith from Deloitte Access Economics, who's going to formally introduce our speaker today. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much, Melinda. Deloitte is absolutely delighted to be sponsoring this event and supporting CEDA and the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia talk about what is one of the most important issues facing our economy and has been for a long time. I'd like to congratulate Melinda and CEDA on assembling this stellar lineup of speakers that we're all privileged to hear from today. In terms of the format, I'll shortly introduce Professor Bob Brunig, who's going to deliver the Keith Hancock lecture. Following the lecture, we're going to break and enjoy lunch, and then Melinda will return to the stage with our panellists, who she will introduce, for a discussion following on from Professor Brunig's presentation. We'll then have a closing from Richard Holden from the Academy. For people who are passionate about public policy in Australia, like we are at Deloitte Access Economics, tax reform is an issue like none other. In Australia, it seems to embody all four of the classical genres: epic, irony, tragedy, and at times some particularly dark form of comedy. And like many others in the room, Deloitte Access Economics has done the modelling. We've published the papers and the reports. We've added to the seemingly 76 libraries full of the collected works dedicated to the reforming of tax in Australia. We've had the genuine privilege of working with some outstanding, passionate, and dedicated public servants who have pushed ideas and have sought to push models and ideas for reform. We've also had the downright displeasure of briefing party apparatchiks masquerading as policy advisers who ask us questions like, and I quote, "Can you alter the parameters of this policy so that nobody will be left worse off?" We know, like you all know, that good tax reform can be good for the economy, it can be good for prosperity for Australia, and it can be good for the budget if done correctly. Indeed, we all know what needs to be done, and yet it doesn't get done. It would be easy simply to lay the blame at the feet of the political class, partly because they make it very easy to do so. Both major parties have turned preserving the status quo into an art form. But a lot of things are easy from the heights of the proverbial ivory tower where economists and public policy pontificators like myself often reside. Tax reform is not easy. It's difficult. And any level of genuine introspection from economists and others promoting tax reform should conclude, in my view, that the arguments have not yet won the day. There are parallels to a certain election taking place just a few days from now, where one of the two candidates in a too-close-to-call coin toss election is advocating the implementation of an average tariff rate last seen literally 100 years ago. Economists will point out all of the arguments against doing that, and note that all of the arguments are overwhelming, and yet it's on the cusp of happening. That should be a source of motivation, a reminder that we need to keep chipping away, that we need to keep making the case, and that we shouldn't give up. Ultimately, tax reform is not about politicians, it's not about economists, it's about Australians and the prosperity of Australia. That's why Deloitte is so pleased to be supporting this event, and why we are proud of our very long association with CEDA. And with that, it is my very great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker. I've been asked to keep this very brief. I understand you all have a more extended bio on your tables. Professor Bob Brunig is one of Australia's leading thinkers on the economics of tax. He's had numerous roles at the Australian National University over a number of years, including director of the Crawford School of Public Policy, and he's currently the director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the Crawford School. He managed to overcome a very difficult early challenge in his career, teaching me second-year econometrics. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Bob Brunig to deliver the Keith Hancock Lecture.
You seem like you've come up all right, Stephen. And recovered from any trauma that might have taken place. Thanks both to CEDA and the Academy for inviting me to give the Hancock Lecture this year. It's a real honor, and I'm really happy to see CEDA and the Academy collaborating on this, and I think hopefully we can have more events like this in the future. So Hancock is one of Australia's most distinguished an accomplished economist. Bob Gregory, one of my mentors, called him the brightest star among labor economists. So it is indeed an honor to be giving this talk in his name. I endeavor, as naive as this sounds, to work on stimulating problems and have a real impact on policy across tax, but also across immigration, childcare, a whole range of areas. And I take inspiration from Keith and the impressive breadth of the work that he's done in doing that. He's had a lot of careers. He worked at the ACTU, was active in the Labor Party. I think he's done everything at a university, from chancellor, vice chancellor, janitor, as far as I can figure out. His research has, you know, extended across gambling, superannuation, macro policy, all influencing policy settings. A lot of our superannuation system reflects the recommendations that he made to the Whitlam government. And he made contributions in business as well, being on the board of the State Bank of South Australia. And he's also a fellow of the Academy, and it's fantastic to be here, Keith, and thanks for all you've done for Australia. I want to mention Sue as well. Sue's done a couple things for me that she might not know about. One of them is that she wrote a great paper about 25 years ago about who actually gets the minimum wage in Australia. And one of the striking things is that the median minimum wage worker in Australia is actually in a household that's in the upper half of the income distribution. And that's just something to reflect on when you think about, you know, policies for alleviating poverty. But I've had my students replicate that over and over, and we continue to find the same thing with the data. Nothing's changed. The other thing Sue did for me is that the very first paper that I accepted, that I submitted to the Economic Record, which is Australia's leading economics journal, Sue rejected. And I repackaged it and submitted it to an A-star journal in the U.S. and got it published there. And so thank you, Sue, for that. That may be something you're not aware of. And really, you know, that's a good story about learning, changing your mind about things and learning as you go along. My university wants to believe that all of its academics can have the kind of impact that Keith did. And my university has this this kind of image that the way impact works is that I tell the government to do something, and then they do it. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to actually ensure my university's wish fulfillment. I'm going to make a bold call to action, and you're my witnesses when my call to action is taken up and it actually happens. My call to action is for the government in the next term to do nothing about tax reform. I call on them to do a tiny bit of symbolic tinkering with the system that adds complexity, and then to claim that they've delivered tax reform. And I call on them to leave the hard work of tax reform, together with the harder work of dealing with the consequences, to someone else down the road, maybe in the midst of some unspecified future economic crisis. I'm glad you mentioned irony, Stephen, when you talked about tax reform. Look, back to the kind of more serious. I'm going to talk a little bit about fairness, and it's one of the things I hope on the panel that we can a theme that we can pick up. Our tax system really is truly not well equipped for the 21st century. And, you know, I'm looking around the room and I see lots of people here who know this better than I do. We've all described the problem eloquently. We've suggested what we think are sensible solutions to the problem. But it's kind of not going forward, right? The bad news is we're in a political environment where implementing substantive tax reform, even when you can get agreement behind closed doors, just seems really, really difficult. And adding to this is a kind of low economic and tax policy literally in Australia. And so what we often hear calls for in tax reform are things that would actually make the system much worse and don't really address the underlying problems. So the talk I'm not going to give today, Melinda, but you can put this on the list of future talks, is, you know, why modern democracies have just become so bad at solving these intractable problems, even when there are obvious solutions. So that's, you know, this is not only a problem in tax. This is a problem in climate. It's a problem in other areas as well. So I want to give a few thoughts that maybe the panel can work on a little bit. When I think about the values of the tax system, I'm usually thinking about something like adequacy, resilience, simplicity, fairness, prosperity. I have great concern, lots of concern about all these things, right? Despite a bit of luck in recent budgets, our underlying financial system has large permanent deficits that are just going to get bigger. Our tax system has serious resiliency risks. We're overly reliant on resource prices, overly reliant in the states on house prices. These are very volatile tax bases. Again, we've kind of gotten lucky. Things could go wrong. We lead the world in the use of tax agents. That's not the hallmark of a simple system. Simple systems don't lead the world in the use of tax agents. And our high corporate tax and relentless bracket creep on the personal side penalize investment and success. This does not lead us down a road of prosperity. But our big normative problem, I think, and where our values and practice really strikingly diverge, comes back to fairness. And partly a general lack of tax system literacy, I think, stops us from addressing some of these fairness issues. So one of the things I thought I might do is dispel a few myths. So myth number one is that intergenerational equity is a problem because old people are rich and young people are poor. This is not a problem. You want to live in a country where the old people are rich and the young people are poor. That means that you're in a country where people worked hard, saved their money, it wasn't confiscated from them by the government, and they were able to save and build for the future. What is the intergenerational equity problem? It's that some young people have rich parents and some young people don't, right? And so this idea of old v. young is actually not the right idea. The right idea really is the haves versus the have-nots, right? If your parents have assets, you're going to be fine. If your parents don't have assets, you might have a hard time getting into the housing market in Australia, right? That's reminiscent of, French Revolution France. So this is not a good place that you want to be in. The second myth, I promised I would only try to take 15 minutes or so, but if I go a little bit over, forgive me, because, Allegra is a politician, and Ken is Ken, so once we're up on the panel, I may not get a word in edgewise, so I figure I have to go for it now. So my myth number two is that taxing corporations taxes rich people. Now, this is actually not, well, in Australia, it's kind of partly true. Taxing corporations doesn't tax rich Australians at all because of our imputation system, right? We're just going to tax people at whatever their personal marginal rate is. We could tax corporations at 50% or 5%. That's not going to change anything. Our corporate tax does tax wealthy investors in mining and banking, but there are probably much better ways to do that, because what our corporate tax also does is penalize investment. There's very well-established literature, I'm very convinced by the empirics, that corporate taxes lead to less investment, and that leads to less jobs. So this is a problem for young people. When we talk about fairness, we really need to think about creating a dynamic environment for young Australians where they can work hard and do well. So myth number three is that the way that you tax the rich is you raise the top marginal tax rate from 47% to 60%, right? Or pick your number, right? Okay, well, what does that do? That taxes people on high salaries, but it does nothing about those people who are holding untaxed wealth. And it creates a big incentive to then just repackage income so it doesn't look like salary. Make it look like a business. Make it look like something else. So you end up taxing a set of kind of sitting ducks who are wage and salary earners. This now sounds self-interested. But then you also incentivize a bunch of behavior that undermines the system. Income is not the problem in Australia, right? The Productivity Commission very convincingly has shown that income inequality is pretty stable over the last 20 years. We actually have very high income mobility relative to most other countries in the Western world. We actually do okay on that. Our problem is wealth. We inoculate a lot of wealth and wealth-derived income completely from the tax net. So this discourages, what economists would call rent-seeking behavior. Or it encourages rent-seeking behavior. It discourages investment, hard work, and productivity. This has to change. The intergenerational contract is the idea that when you're young, you're going to receive benefits from the government. As you get older and start working, you're going to pay tax. And then as you get older, you're going to receive benefits back from the government. And we smooth people's income across their lifetime through this intergenerational contract. That's fallen apart in Australia. If you look back to the 90s, young people and old people in kind of total income And if you think about Haig-Simons, I can be technical in this group, you know, income, all the income derived from your wealth, young and old people kind of ended up in the same place. Fast forward to today, young people haven't moved, older people are up here on average, right? Why is that? It's probably a good news story, right? It's probably a story of asset values having increased, and that wealth having accrued to older people, but it's also a story about the fact that in our tax and transfer system, we really heavily means test all the transfers that we give to young people, but we don't means test the transfers that we give to old people. And that's kind of a bit odd when you look at it. If you landed from another planet and you looked at that, you would sort of say, I'm not sure that this makes a whole lot of sense. And our tax and transfer system, the way it's set up, is not really equipped to deal with this imbalance. I've written a lot about the fact that we completely exempt owner-occupied housing from tax, you know, superannuation tax concessions often are subsidies for large bequests, which is a sort of odd thing. You know, I wouldn't get up and say, I have a policy to give tax breaks to rich people so they can donate more money to their children. Most people, you know, if you said that, most voters would reject that, I think. And yet that's a lot of what our system does. So let me, Bob, blather on. I let me just suggest two possible things that we could think about and maybe that the panel could react to. One is that there is no constitutional impediment to having a federal property tax. So a broad-based tax on the unimproved value of land that would cover all land irrespective of use. This is a good policy. This is something that we should bring in place. This can bring us more revenue. It's not distortionary. If you tax land, it doesn't stop working hard. It doesn't move to Malaysia. The land doesn't do anything, right? And it's really important that we incorporate owner-occupied housing. And we can do this. I've written a whole bunch of papers about how you might do this. One way you might do it is have the federal government bring this in and say to the states, we'll give you the money back if you get rid of your stamp duties. This could be done overnight. This is very simple. And everybody agrees this is a good thing. The second thing that I'm going to suggest that I think would improve fairness a lot, and it'll bring me to my last point, is to get rid of the tax-free threshold and replace it with an earned income tax credit. Why would I do that? Because that would reward people who work for their income, and it would tax people who are getting capital income at the very first dollar of their capital income. So, you know, think about the debate of we should get rid of franking credits. That's a bad debate, right? If we have a comprehensive system, we should tax people at their correct marginal tax rate. So franking credits are good. The problem is we're not taxing people at their correct marginal tax rate. We're taxing them at something else, right? The other thing you could do is you could say, I'm not going to tax your superannuation income, but I'm going to treat your superannuation income as the base from which I tax all your other income. So imagine a retiree who gets $80,000 of superannuation, gets a dollar of dividend. I'm not going to tax them at 30 cents. That's not going to be under the tax-free threshold. That's more of a Band-Aid solution, but it would achieve a similar thing. Of course, none of this is as good as a dual tax system, which would have a separate schedule for savings income from earned income, which has worked very well in Scandinavian countries. All right. I'm going to close with a prediction. And this is either a good prediction or a bad prediction, kind of depending upon, you know, where you sit, which is that what's going to happen to Australia if we kind of continue down the path that we're on of not reforming the tax system, of the other talk I am not going to give Melinda is my talk about regulation and a lack of dynamism in the economy, but going down this track that we're on, what are we going to end up like? And the answer is we're going to end up like France or Italy, right? Good food, good wine, a good place to be old, a good place to have assets. Not a great place to be young and dynamic. A lot of out-migration of our best skilled people. So in some ways, that's not... You know, sometimes people say, oh, will it be a huge disaster if we don't have tax reform? I think that's a disaster for young people, but it's not like the country's going to fall over. So on that note, the thing I can tell you, though, is that Allegra promised that she's going to be optimistic, so you've got something to look forward to. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We are going to get going with the what is going to be an interesting conversation, I am sure. I don't even have to say I hope. You've already met Bob, so I won't introduce Bob again, but joining us on stage, of course, Dr. Ken Henry, AC, former Secretary of the Commonwealth Treasury and Academy Fellow and, of course, author of the compendium of all things tax reform. Allegra Spender, MP, Federal Member for Wentworth and Member of and House of Representatives Standing on Economics. Yep. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to have you and your Teal colleagues who are bringing such a nice, insightful approach to all things policy. And then Angela Stevens, who is a JD student at the Melbourne Law School and part of the Think Forward group. So one of the things that you will hopefully see on the CEDA stage is us trying to make sure we're broadening perspectives and bringing all voices into the conversation. And so thank you, Angela, for joining us and entering the fray, so to speak. Now, over here. Hopefully you can now continue to hear me. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. Bob, you had a chance to talk, so I'm going to ask the others a question each. And while they're sort of formulating their responses, you all have an opportunity to jump on to Pigeonhole and ask your questions. I would really love for you to drive this conversation, because one of the comments that Bob made is that we're not getting... I think the simple conclusion and fair conclusion is that we haven't won the day with arguments. So one of the things that's interesting to hear from you is what are the perspectives you're bringing, what are the questions you're asking that we may not have already asked ourselves, given that many of us have been in this conversation for a pretty long time. So jump onto Pigeonhole and I will endeavour to ask your questions. But Ken, let me start with you. You finished the tax review 15 years ago. There was a lot of interest and I think a lot of excitement and energy that maybe we were finally going to get things done. From all the work that you did, are there things that you still think sit right at the top of the priority list, and or are there different things that we need to be doing, and what have you learned about the failed attempt to get reform up in many cases and the repeal of some really important taxes that would have made a huge difference?
Yeah, and the last part of the question is I think probably the most instructive. Because I was thinking, I've been thinking about what I should say here, because I've said a lot about tax over a large number of years, too much perhaps. One question, and it's really the way I interpret your question, what's changed? Like, would I write the same thing again? And so what has occurred to me is that some things that we, the review team, took for granted when we were writing the review, we started about mid-2008, just before the global financial crisis. But when we were writing it, some of the things we took for granted, we don't have anymore. And some of the things that we now have, we would not have had the tax review been implemented in its entirety. And I thought maybe I could just start with 30 seconds, or maybe it's a minute, reminding people of some of these things. So firstly, I would say that today, the Charter of Budget Honesty, legislated in Australia in 1997, no longer has any carriage politically whatsoever. Mm. It has no resonance politically whatsoever. You might recall that the centrepiece of the Charter of Budget Honesty Act was that the government articulate a medium-term fiscal strategy, right, that explains how the hell you get the system anchored to a structural balance. The political parties don't think that that's meaningful, and in fact they have not bothered to articulate a medium-term fiscal strategy as required by that legislation for quite some time. We took for granted, so we took for granted that there would be a medium-term fiscal strategy as required by the Charter of Budget Honesty. We took for granted that Australia would have a comprehensive carbon price, courtesy of the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. We took for granted that there would be substantial Commonwealth-state financial relations reform. We did not imagine that a government would do what was done for Western Australia, that rather obscene deal with the GST distribution. We did not imagine that COVID would be handled in the way that it was handled. I mean, as I was saying at the table just now, the spectacle of Commonwealth and state governments pointing fingers at one another about who's responsible for people dying in aged care homes. I mean, for God's sake. For God's sake. So, no, I did not imagine that. We did not foresee the electrification of the motor vehicle fleet, but had our recommendations been accepted, nobody would have needed to blink an eye, because that would have, the electrification of the fleet would have been seamlessly integrated with no revenue consequence, like none at all, for anybody. We did not foresee that the Australian population would tolerate real wages falling with average rates of income tax going up courtesy of fiscal drag. That is a complete shock to me and should shock everybody. It would not have been tolerated in the 1980s. It would not have been tolerated in the 1990s. It has been tolerated now. Honestly, I find it difficult to get my head around it, that it is tolerated. We did identify housing affordability as being an emerging pressure issue. I did not at the time imagine it would get as bad as it's got. And I could go on, but I won't. I would say, in those areas, given those developments, there are some new opportunities, right? And maybe we'll get to them on carbon, where I think there's an opportunity to use carbon policy to drive huge change to the Australian economy, but maybe we'll get to that.
I was expecting some reference to the mining resource rent tax.
Yeah. So, we've had a really long resources boom that is responsible for an appreciation of the real exchange rate that has been sustained for a very long period now, and which has done enormous damage to the rest of the economy. And yet most people in Australia continue to believe the bullshit that the resources boom is underwriting Australian prosperity. If you believe that, and maybe there are people in this room who do, you need some re-education on some basic economics. But anyway, that's a rather serious thing. It's a rather serious problem in Australia. And right now, you know, actually, if I have my time again, I would just, right now, I would impose a tax on Australia's fossil fuel exports. And the reason I would do it is because other countries are going to do it, like Europe, under its carbon border adjustment mechanism, will start to apply such a tax from 2030, so we might as well do it. And if you think this is inconsequential or a second order issue, let me tell you that if we were to use the present carbon price in Europe and apply that to our fossil fuel exports, that would net us $156 billion a year in additional revenue. This is not second order stuff. Anyway, I might do that.
Thanks, Ken. Allegra, you've made the point about tax reform not being driven by the principles, I might say, the evidence as well, but have flagged the real importance of public perception. Yeah. I mean, tax reform was one of these areas we were talking at our table as well around issues like, you know, increasing job seeker payments, where there's just this wall of evidence that supports it as good policy, but we can't get it to happen. What's your role, do you think, in that space? And I guess more generally, what do we need to do differently in order to shift public perceptions or bring public perception into the conversation in a way to affect change?
Mm. Look, I think, you know, the problem with tax reform is it's too easy to wedge people on it. And I think that's why we haven't, you know, had real reform for the last 20 years. It is too easy to wedge and to create scare campaigns. Mm. And also, I think we have some, you know, very erudite people, including on this panel, making very strong arguments. But, you know, we need to actually have those conversations, you know, literally in the barbecues, at a community level, as well as at an expert level. And, you know, that's for me, the biggest learning is we're not going to get tax reform until the community knows why and says, you know, we've got a problem, we need to solve it, and they back that. And so I think I think there are a ton of two different elements to that. One is that I think we need to really articulate what's going wrong. And, you know, the community has cottoned on to housing. So, you know, people realise that You know, kids, they're young, you know, their children, their grandchildren are not getting a fair deal. I think people realise that, you know, if you're a policewoman and a teacher and, you know, traditionally in Australia you should be able to buy a house and have a good life, you know, you can't do that unless you've got people backing you in your parents. And I think that's grating on the community, because I don't think that's how we as a country see ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to... I think that's actually the opportunity to raise that, you know, for young people, as you described, Bob, you know, in the last, I think the Grattan numbers I looked at, which saw that households over the age of 65 from 2004 to 2016 increased their wealth by around 50%. Households under the age of 35 didn't increase their wealth pretty much. And, you know, we need to sort of keep on talking about this, because it's how people feel, and then we can start to actually say it's not just because you know, young people, you know, having going out for avocado toast. Frankly, they're actually spending less money now on non-essentials than previous generations. And we need to keep on really, I think, highlighting the personal story around this, because, you know, you're not going to motivate the Australian community around, you know, terms like productivity, sadly, or you know, or fiscal drag. I think you're going to motivate them when they think that their kids don't have a chance, when, you know, they see that, you know, young people aren't even building businesses anymore, where we say that real wages haven't gone up, you know, 80% driven by productivity, and we have, you know, the last 10 years has been the worst productivity for decades. So we have to have the conversation in terms that matter to people in their day-to-day lives. And then I think we have to be deliberate in engaging them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I've been someone sort of pushing things like citizens' assemblies. These ideas of actually getting ordinary Australians together to say, okay, these are some of the challenges. Listen to some experts, listen to experts, interrogate them, choose the experts you want to talk to, and then come to some views, you know, how you kind of wish our parliament would come to, which is like, can you come to something that 80% of the community agrees with, 80% of, you know, a group of randomly selected Australians would agree with? There are different ways, you know, that's not maybe a perfect model, but I think we have to think differently about how we engage our communities. And the other night in Wentworth... in my community, you know, we sort of said a piece out, hey, we're doing some work on tax, we wanted to consult the community. So we got 120 people put their hands up, rainy Wednesday night. Young and old, you know, some people with real expertise, some people not. We broke everyone up into groups of 10. And then we said, okay, you know, these are the sort of, you know, tax levers you can pull. We had some expert, you know, introduction at the start, and then they talked about trade-offs, and we said, no, you can't just lower tax on all everything and, you know, and that's okay. You actually have to go, well, how are you going to, you know, pay for the things you care about, and, you know, how can you manage the trade-offs? And, you know, even just in, you know, an hour or so's discussion, there were quite sophisticated conversations and quite a sophisticated conversation of around the trade-offs for different people. And I think we've got to build this conversation. So to come to your first part of the question, you know, why I'm pursuing tax because the political wedging means that, you know, the major parties aren't. And I'm pursuing tax because I think we as a country need to have that conversation, and I think we've got to get the communities as part of that conversation, not sort of, you know, they don't trust experts perhaps the way they did in previous generations. You know, people actually want to feel like they've got a stake and they've got a voice, and I think we have to engage the experts and the community at the same time. Mm. And we need to know what's the problem we're trying to solve? Because then I think we have the best chance of getting there.
Yeah. I think one of the other things too, we did some research a few years ago now, but when you ask people essentially what are the policy issues that really matter to them, tax is down the list,
yeah,
right? But all of the things that tax pays for are not,
yeah,
and they're front and centre. So I think having part of this conversation be, this is the way we fund the services that enhance your well-being,
yeah,
and how do we think about that as part of the social compact is really important as well.
It is, and how do we give our kids a better opportunities, you know, make sure that they aren't actually going to go backwards, because, yeah, you know, when you look at what's happened in other countries, including the US, you know, this sense that you don't have options, you don't have hope for certain people in the country, yeah, that's actually going to drive polarisation, that's going to drive bad politics. So,
yeah, sure,
you know, those things, but also, you know, you've got a, you know, productivity, aspiration, innovation. Australians like that too.
So, Angela, I'm going to just give you the open question here, which is, As the youngest person on this panel by a little bit, how about this as an opening? Does Australia's tax system give you hope?
Unfortunately not. I just want to say thank you so much to all of the other speakers for your contributions today. It's such an honour to be on this panel and to be representing Think Forward. I think the strongest possible case that we can make for pursuing tax reform in Australia is that tax reform relates to how our society is economically structured. And of course, our tax system at the moment is deeply intergenerationally unfair. And that comes down to two things. It comes down to the choices that we've made, and it comes down to the control that we've had over those choices. So what we see, obviously, is there are some factors that are not within our control. We do have an aging population. It costs $500,000 to build a home in aged care today. Someone has to pay for those kinds of costs, and so naturally those kinds of burdens do have to fall on taxpayers. However, there are some choices that successive governments have made of both political persuasions that have left us worse off in every possible way in our tax system. And that is, of course, by continuing to prioritise tax concessions that explicitly favour two groups of people, and that is older people, and that is also those that are already wealthy. And we see that, of course, with the CGT, and, of course, the Henry Review did recommend that be reduced to 40%. And so what these tax concessions in particular tell us is that they leave younger generations in a position where we have to pay for these tax concessions while we're also competing with property speculators so that we can buy a home. And so these kinds of dire circumstances where we don't have the choice, where we feel like we don't have the control, nor do we feel like we have the choice to build our own wealth and our own futures, has left us with a real lack of trust in government. Mm. Think Forward has done multiple surveys with thousands of young people, and if you look at our website, we've produced several reports with the results from those surveys. And one of the most striking findings from those surveys is that 87% of the young people that we've surveyed simply don't trust our politicians to do the work that really matters and to prioritise their interests when it comes to tax policy. And only 10% of those that we surveyed believe that the costs and benefits of tax reform are shared equally. And of course, I think the most important thing that we can do about this, and actually, Ken, this goes to a point that you made when you launched Mixed Fortunes, is this idea that the best possible thing that we can do is we must have a tax reform agenda that speaks everyone's language. I think these conversations are incredibly important because, you know, we can talk about dividends and efficiency, and those concepts are really, really important because we need the knowledge to do the modelling, to do the forecasting so that we can build that evidence base. But once you have that evidence base, it's about translating that evidence into compelling arguments that resonate with people so that we don't have these old versus young divides. Mm-hmm. We don't have these divides between haves and have-nots. It's about understanding, okay, well, how can we convince older people that tax reform for young people is important? Mm-hmm. How can we convince the haves that tax reform for the have-nots is important? Mm-hmm. They're the conversations that we need to be having. That's the work that Think Forward is doing. And the fact that you're all here today shows that you understand just how important that exact mission is.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I'm looking forward to having Think Forward on the stage a lot because one of the things that is going to drive all of CEDA's work, tax reform and everything else, is actually trying to imagine what a better future looks like and talk to that story rather than sort of continually looking back over our shoulders and polishing the same kind of problems in the same language with the same sort of solutions. I've got a whole bunch of questions here and I'm trying to pick and choose which one I come to. I promise I'm going to ask you a question, Bob, but I've got to come back to Ken because you said carbon.
Mm.
And the first two questions in one way or another. So the first question is from Sue Richardson, which is a basic principle of tax design is to tax things you want less of. Is there anything that we want less of that is more significant than greenhouse gas emissions? Which then comes back to Mary's question, which is can we talk about carbon tax?
Mm. So, well, no, but with one qualification, right, which is that, you know, that there are things that produce, there's a whole variety of things that produce carbon emissions. The most egregious is surely chopping down forests to produce carbon emissions. So, is chopping down forests worse than producing carbon emissions? Well, actually, I think it is. but it produces carbon emissions anyway. Look, I think so. We've got a lot of work to do on carbon policy, but my view, for what it's worth, is that we are going to end up with a national price, an economy-wide price on carbon, courtesy of the safeguard mechanism and the renewable energy technology schemes being overtaken by sectoral decarbonisation plans that will get us to net zero only if we can find a way, net zero by 2050, I mean, only if we can get find a way of increasing the sequestration of carbon in the Australian landscape by about 35%. Now, we have to be smart enough to do that. And I reckon we are smart enough to do that. That means that Australian carbon credit units, which have a bit of a tarnished reputation right now, are going to have to become the gold standard instrument for getting us to net zero by 2050. They'll be tradable right across the economy, and that will give us a uniform price on carbon. So that's how I see it happening. And I think we should all be putting our shoulders to the wheel to make that happen. By the way, we surely have to be clever enough to figure out how we can ensure that 35% increase in carbon sequestered in the Australian landscape is done in a way that improves the condition of the natural environment rather than makes it worse by planting Pinus radiata or some monocultural eucalyptus species across the Australian landscape. And we are surely smart enough to do that. A foundation that I chair, which happens to be pretty well funded, gives us enough money to buy some decent modelling work. We reckon that we have figured out how to design a nature-positive Australian carbon credit unit scheme that would deliver $10 billion a year to nature repair across the Australian economy between 2030 and 2050. So we know it can be done. And done in a way that does not have a carbon price in Australia above the price cap that Chris Bowen has said should feature in the safeguard mechanism, namely $75 a tonne in 2035, rising at CPI plus 2%. So we know it can be done.
Right, we'll get you back on the stage to give us the details of that.
Will.
Bob, where does superannuation taxation fit into your thinking?
Wow. I was just desperately afraid that someone was going to ask me that question.
Well, the question it was more specific, which is around a higher tax for those who've got more than $3 million in super. But this issue of wealth inequality.
Look, I've written a bunch about superannuation taxation over the past 7 years, and if you take all my writings and compare them, you'll find that they're contradictory. and I kind of view that as a flexible mind who's willing to evolve in the way that they think about things. I think superannuation tax concessions are about right for the median Australian. Right? If you look at the European pay-as-you-go systems, where people pay into a social security system and then they get income when they retire, there's tax concessions built into those. I think for the median Australian earner, our tax concessions probably about right. If you want to tax a little bit more out of there, you could have a tax on superannuation income in retirement, or you could continue, this might be a good idea, to continue to tax accumulation and tax the accumulation of the fund in retirement. I think where superannuation still is really unfair is at the very high balance level. Mm. And I've kind of actually, I'm sort of thinking now that maybe what we should do is just say there's a maximum amount that you can have in superannuation and index that to inflation and then just make people pull it out of super. If it's above that amount. This is for retirement. Here's what we think is a reasonable amount to have for retirement. We're not stopping you from saving any more. We're just not going to let you use this system to do it. And one of the problems we have is that people have kind of misused it, right? So there's a bunch of businesses, farms that are run through self-managed superannuation funds. This is not what a self-managed superannuation fund was designed to do, right? It's just that the tax incentives were very strong. So people put their farm inside of that. What's the solution to that? We just say to people, well, we're not going to allow that anymore. You've got 1 year to pull it out without any penalty and then go structure that the way you're supposed to structure a business. So there's a few ideas.
Okay.
But I'm happy to have my mind changed on that too, like literally. So.
Well, thanks for being honest about the fact that you have, you're fluid in your thinking.
Thank you.
Richard, I'm just going to put you on notice that I'm going to ask Allegra one more question, and I knew we were going to run out of time, but a quick question to Allegra, and then I'm going to invite Richard to the stage. Allegra, you've been now sitting there watching the political to and fro. It's clear there's no appetite out of the major parties for tax reform writ large. You know, one of the debates we sort of have as economists is there an opportunistic sort of door that we can open that might create space for something bigger? Mm. Is there a tax issue that you think we can open the door on, or is it all just too hard?
I guess I think there are possibly a couple, one of which is road user charging, and because of the ruling before about how Victoria had structured their road their sort of prices in relation to electric vehicles. So that is an issue of ambiguity now in tax, and so I think this is something where you could start there, and I know that's something that Ken suggested. I also think something around the stamp duty land tax, it's an area where the feds could provide a variety of sort of incentives or opportunities for states to actually take some of that reform forward. But I also believe that, to be honest, I think that there's an opportunity to put a process of reform on the agenda, and that's certainly what I'm pushing for, and I will be pushing for if I'm elected again, and particularly if it ends up in a more of a sort of balanced parliament minority environment, is to say, look, let's put a process around tax reform back on the agenda, because the last process we had was the one that Ken led. But this is a different type of piece. This is that, we've got a lot of the academic research, we've done a lot of the hard thinking. This is actually about engaging the community, but also the stakeholders in the trade-offs. And I've been doing that myself through engaging with academics, with Corporate Tax Institute, with BCA and ACOS and those guys on some of that. And that's why we're putting out a green paper to provoke the conversation. But I think the opportunity is in the next parliament is to take that to the next stage and put forward some sort of process, and also have institutions, think about how else could we structure our institutions, within government to be pushing on tax reform, like the Law Reform Commission, Productivity Commission. There are we have bodies that we can use to provoke some of that discussion further. So I think we have to have an institutional approach and then a bit of tactical, as you say, some tactical opportunities there.
And a bit of the political economy of it all.
Yep, and political economy of it. But I think keep talking. I mean, it's wonderful what CETA does. It is, and I know many people in this room are pushing this. And it, it is a, it weighs in. It makes a difference if people continue to say this is what we need. It permeates. You get more and more journos, across different groups, like the telly, and as well as the Finn or this, the journos you'd expect starting to saying, yeah, we do need to talk about this. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. It is now my great pleasure to invite to the stage Richard Holden, President of the Academy of Social Sciences, to make some closing comments. As he's walking up to the stage, I will say one of the other things, Ken talked about the Charter of Budget Honesty. There's all these other sort of instruments, if you like, or tools that have been put in place that we just don't use anymore. Mm. Intergenerational report. We've been pushing for a long time for a whole of Federation intergenerational report, so you can't play whack-a-mole with tax and spending. And I think that's one of the things we're going to have to bring into this tax conversation as well, is the state and federal divide beyond just GST. Sorry, Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks, Melinda. I am really, really pleased as President of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia that we're doing this event jointly with CEDA. And thank you to Melinda and your team and Chris Hatherley, Bonnie Johnson and the Academy team for making that possible. Not many people know this, but CEDA was actually founded by former Academy President Sir Douglas Copeland. So it's very nice to see our close association with CEDA, if not coming full circle, then coming back closely together, and I sincerely hope that will continue. Thank you very much to Deloitte for their sponsorship of the event, and I'd like to acknowledge, of course, Keith Hancock, after whom the Keith Hancock Lecture is named. Keith is an incredibly distinguished Australian and economist, and has been an inspiration to young Australian economists like I used to be, I guess, over the years, and continues to be. I'd also like to acknowledge one of my other predecessors, Sue Richardson. I served with Sue on the executive committee of the Academy for several years. which was an incredibly enjoyable and important learning experience for me. And so I'm really grateful for your encouragement and support over many years. Tax reform is obviously a pressing economic issue, but it's also an incredibly important social issue. Australia is an outlier among advanced economies in the degree to which we rely on income tax compared to other forms of taxation, like consumption taxes, like land tax, like resource rent taxes. And as I've said in my financial review column, this makes our tax system not only out of date, not only not necessarily fit for purpose, but it makes it really a tax on social mobility. And that tight linkage between the need for tax reform and to deal with some of our pressing social problems is very apparent. It's become clear, unfortunately, over recent years that our housing affordability crisis is an intergenerational tragedy, and our tax system both contributes to that and is also part of the solution to it. Many people have commented that there's been no serious tax reform in Australia for 25 years, and there are many reasons for that. And while I don't have all the answers, I know that discussions like this today with this group of people is for sure an important part of the solution to getting tax reform back on the agenda and moving Australia forward. It involves bringing together academics, people from politics and government, the business community, journalists, Ross Gittins, Academy Fellow, and others. And I think this room is testament to what it takes to bring people together in order to make progress on these issues. I'd of course like to thank the panellists, first Bob Brunig for delivering the Keith Hancock lecture with his characteristic wit and insight, and to Allegra, Angela and Ken for their great contributions to the panel and for being here. It's very much appreciated. Bob said towards the end of his remarks that Australia is a great place to be old, and I take some personal comfort in that. But I think everyone in this room wants it to be a great place to be young, and it's my view that making Australia a great place to be young involves also making Australia a great place in which to invest, and that's why the kind of discussions we're having today are so important. Thank you again very much.
Well, thanks, everyone. That does conclude today's proceedings. But if you're looking for something more to do, please jump on the website because we've got a couple of really good events coming up, including with the RBA Governor, Michelle Bullock. So if you're interested in that or any of the other events, I've already given you a bit of a heads up that we're going to drag Ken back on to talk about all things carbon. And no doubt we're going to get Angela back on to continue to give us her interesting perspectives. And Allegra, always welcome. Bob, you're part of the fabric, so... but ceda.com.au, thank you so much for being here, and please look forward to more on this topic and everything else that's going to be important to making Australia great for young people. Thank you.